Okay, thank you, Zhiwen, for inviting me, and it's always a pleasure for me to come back here. I come back here quite often, basically because I teach at PSI. I've not given a talk, not to students, for a few years here, but it's a great pleasure for me. Okay, so this is the title of my talk, Quantum Complexity and the Emergence of Irreversibility, and it's based on a bunch of works dating since 2009, and this is the most recent one, and I think that maybe very soon Zhiwen and I will put out something else along these lines. And so originally this subject, this line of research for me was about trying to understand irreversibility in quantum mechanics, and now it's about other things together with that. So maybe irreversibility is not exactly the main focus right now, but I still want to keep it in the title because I get to show this very funny video, which is very cute. So this is a video that is shot or shown in reverse. Let me just show it to you. Let's see if it works. Hello? Oh. Okay. There you go. Okay, so the fun thing about this video is that actually it is not shown in reverse. This is the actual video. The guy's just pretending to go reverse. And I find it interesting because, you know, usually when we talk about irreversibility, we always look at these videos of the egg getting scrambled, and then obviously we are able to recognize when the video is shot in reverse because, you know, things don't go spontaneously back. But so this video shows that this notion of when, you know, when something is irreversible or not can be subtle, right? It's not always so easy to recognize. And of course, you know, this is just for fun, but there is a little wisdom to it. And of course, the problem in quantum mechanics, which is what I'm interested in, is that quantum mechanics is reversible because evolution for a closed quantum system is unitary. So unitarity means it's time reversal. If you have an evolution described by unitary U, if you just apply U Dagger, you go back exactly to the initial state. And in fact, you also do not have quantum chaos in the sense of classical chaos. If you change a little bit your initial conditions and you evolve, different initial conditions do not diverge because the evolution is unitary and it's norm preserving. The distance between states as they evolve stays constant. So, you know, you don't really have chaos, at least in this sense. We all learned that entropy is constant with unitary evolution. For instance, if you start in a pure state that has zero entropy, it will always have zero entropy. So one hint to the fact that there is something that can increase with unitary evolution, it comes from entanglement, because entanglement entropy can increase when you have a unitary evolution. But does that really mean irreversibility, right? Because you can have entropy that is increasing for some evolutions, but then for some other evolution could be decreasing. For instance, again, if you take the U dagger, you go back. So just the fact that entropy can increase does not automatically mean that you have irreversibility. However, if, you know, if quantum theory is right, and it is right, so we start from the point of view that quantum theory is right, and irreversibility is definitely something that we observe, it must come out of something. And the point of view of this talk is that irreversibility is a feature of something that I would like to call quantum complexity. Okay, so what is quantum complexity? And this notion lately has attracted a lot of attention. There are several people that work on this topic here at PI, and there are two approaches. One approach that you know is was put forward by very illustrious people like Kolmogorov, sorry for the typo, and Susskind, says, you know, complexity, it's relative to some starting point. So it's some quantum state is complex relatively to a fiducial state, is the least number of elementary operations that you need starting from the starting point to get to your state. So if you need a lot of elementary operations, then you have a very complex quantum state. If you need just a few, then it's not very complex. This is a point of view that is reminiscent of the point of view of Gibbs in statistical mechanics. For Gibbs, in order to make ensemble averages, you actually need to reach all those states. So if you reach them multiple times with an evolution that is complex enough, that is ergodic, then you can substitute dynamical temporal averages, that is what you would observe, with ensemble averages, and this is the way he gives a foundation to statistical mechanics. In this talk, we take a different approach to quantum complexity, and we say that the state is complex if it belongs to a large equivalence class. So if there are many, many other quantum states that look like that, and looking if they look alike, means they're very difficult to tell apart. And this is Boltzmann's point of view in statistical mechanics, right? So you say that a state, a configuration has a lot of entropy, not because it's the configuration that has a lot of entropy. Every single configuration has entropy zero, but because it belongs to a class of equivalent configurations that are equivalent from some macroscopic point, which means what I can actually tell apart, but they're in equivalent microscopically, which is what you cannot see. Okay, so we are taking this point of view here, okay? So maybe I have a state, so just to understand the difference between these two points of view, maybe I have a state that requires just a few operations, elementary operations, to be created, but it is indistinguishable from many, many, many other states that maybe most of them require a lot of operations because, you know, the more operations you make, the more configurations you have. This is true. But if it is indistinguishable from those, it's complex even if its Kolmogorov or Susskind complexity is very low. It should be not worthy that Gibbs and Boltzmann point of view are perfectly equivalent in statistical mechanics at equilibrium. So that's why we actually like to make calculations with Gibbs' point of view, because they are very easy and natural. But they're not equivalent away from equilibrium. So when you study fluctuations away from equilibrium, that's a very sophisticated field, and the two points of view are not really equivalent. Okay, so, yep.
What's the meaning of distinguish? Is it constrained by local measurement?
I'll explain right now. So right now I just wanted to give the notion in a very vague way. So one defines macroscopic, that which you can distinguish, and microscopic, that you cannot distinguish. So if you have many microscopic configurations, they are in the same equivalence class because it's very hard to tell them apart. And for us, this telling apart, so I come to your question, is about entanglement. Okay? So we are trying to distinguish some features of the entanglement pattern in the wave function. So Imagine that you have a state belongs to a landscape of entanglement that has many, many local minima. So this means that if you do a local small transformation to your state, then the entanglement doesn't change very much, fluctuates very little. So you have many, many local minima in the sense of the local operations that you can make. So it's very difficult to distinguish the pattern of entanglement between states that are in this landscape. As a result, trying to disentangle the state would be very hard. Because what is that you can do to try to disentangle a state? You could do something like a Metropolis algorithm, right? You could do... I will explain this algorithm in a minute, but basically what you will do is to do some random local unitary operation and then trying to cool down the entanglement. Okay, so we study this problem in two settings. The first setting is that of a random quantum circuit. So we have a system of n qubits, and our initial state is a product state. So we want to start from a random product state that does not have any type of entanglement whatsoever in that tensor product structure, that of the initial qubits. And then we first start to entangle the state with a random quantum circuit. So we draw random gates between random qubits, and we look at the entanglement step by step. We call this process entanglement heating, because you can imagine that the entanglement will start increasing since you start from zero entanglement. It is a known fact, in any way we show it, that at some point the entanglement equilibrates to a value that is very close to the maximum possible value of entanglement for that system. At this point, we try to reverse the evolution and disentangle the state. So here is where the notion of irreversibility comes about. If you knew the circuit, by applying the dagger, the inverse of the circuit, you would go back to the initial state, which is a product state. But let's say that you don't know the circuit. So you're just trying to guess what circuit would get you back to the initial state. This is also, if you want, a learnability problem, right? You want to learn what is the set of gates that has created that state, starting from that fiducial state. So we call this entanglement cooling. And so what gates are we using? We are using the NOT gate, the Hadamard gate, the phase gate with phase pi over 4 or pi over 2, and the CNOT gate. So I don't need to explain these gates to this audience. But when I give this talk to people who do condensed matter theory, sometimes I have to explain these gates. So as you know, these sets of gates, the Hadamard, the CNOT, and the S gate, are dense in the Clifford group, which is a non-universal group. So you cannot, it's not ergodic. You cannot reach any possible quantum state by iterating the usage of these gates. Hadamard, CNOT, and NOT also is not universal, it's not even Clifford. Yeah. Okay. And finally, Hadamard, the CNOT, and the phase gate with pi over 4 is universal. So if you use an exponential number of these gates, you can reach any kind of quantum state that you want. So we monitor according to different measures of entanglement. This is called S bar because this is the average entanglement along all the possible bipartitions of your system. So if you have n qubits, you have one qubit versus all the others, two qubit versus all the others, and so on and so forth. Yeah?
What do you mean by your NOT gate in that? You can't do NOT gate in quantum computing. Do you mean X?
Yeah, I mean X. Yeah, the spin clip. And the parameter Q are different to any entropies. In particular, Q1 is the von Neumann entropy, Q0 is the rank of the reduced density matrix. And we monitor it for the three different set of gates. And you see that entanglement increases and then equilibrates to a maximum, to the maximum for this type of measure. And that's it. And as you can see, there is no difference in how the entanglement behaves for these very different types of circuits. Okay? So this is one first lesson that we should learn, is that entanglement by itself, how much entanglement you can create, doesn't tell you much about complexity. This was well known in many communities. It's also one of the starting points of Susskind when he starts thinking about quantum complexity. He says, hey, entanglement by itself, it is what it is. Even a very simple system can entangle you very much. Okay, so this was well known. Okay, at this point, we try to cool the entanglement down. Okay, so we do our Metropolis algorithm, which is this algorithm. So we take note of how much is the entanglement, we choose a random gate, we apply the gate, we recompile, we recompute the entanglement entropy, and if we reduce the average entanglement entropy about all the bipartitions, then we keep this gate. If the entropy increases, we only keep it with the Boltzmann probability, okay? So e to the minus beta delta s, where delta s is the increase in entanglement. And then we reiterate, and we only stop when the entanglement entropies are zero. And because this is the average entanglement entropy across all the bipartitions, when they are zero, means the state is completely factorized. And then it's an elementary task to go back to the actual initial state. Means that we have actually reverted the evolution. Okay, so these are the results. And let's see if I am able to use this. Okay, so here we see what happens with, these are two instances, two realizations of a random quantum circuit with the gates that belong to the generators of the Clifford group. So in red is the heating part. At this point, we try to reverse entanglement and it goes down, okay? So you see, we are able in a very efficient way by gradient descent of actually learning exactly what circuit we need to go back to the initial state. If we have a universal set of gates, nothing happens. And if we keep going, nothing happens. And the only time when we see something happening if we do exhaustive search. So which for 14 or 16 qubits we could never do because we don't have so much time. But for like 4 qubits, at some point you're able to try all the possible circuits and then you can go back. So this is what we call irreversibility. Irreversibility doesn't come from the fact that the unitary operator that disentangles you does not exist, but that you cannot find it. Unless you find exhaustively, you look exhaustively in the set of all the possible quantum circuits. Yeah?
So I'm assuming on the right hand side, the acceptance rate in the Metropolis algorithm is practically zero.
So if you zoom in, you see that actually there are very tiny fluctuations. But they are very tiny, which means that, again, the thing that I was saying, that the landscape of entropy has many, many minima, local minima.
What about the left-hand side? Do you really know what's the acceptance rate?
Sorry, I understand the question.
The acceptance rate in the Metropolis algorithm, do we know?
That's a very good question. I don't remember.
Okay, but I assume that they have to have some parameter, I mean,
So the acceptance rate, so you mean the temperature, the beta?
No, for example, when you're running this algorithm, then you have a criteria, say you generate a random number, then there's a probability that you do
right
do that operation or not, right?
Yeah, so I actually don't know what is the acceptance rate.
Okay.
So yeah, but that's a very interesting question. Okay.
Oh, also, so for the first graph, the network that you get to cool down this entanglement is the same as a network.
Yes, very good question. So we use, as a random quantum circuit for cooling, the same type of gates.
I mean, so the result is, it's just the inverse of the previous gate, of the previous circuit?
It's
always different.
It's a matrix that has a row in common with the. It is the quantum circuit that disentangles you, but there are more than one that disentangles you. So it is a circuit that has one row in common with the initial circuit, not all the rows.
So they are not always the inverse of each other.
No, they are only the inverse of each other on that state. This is what I mean. They were rowing. Okay. So, if my claim,
You mentioned for the right figures, only if you do an exhaustive search, you will be able to reduce it.
Yeah.
How do you know only?
So you mean if I have a proof of that? Yeah, the what I'm gonna say is unpublished. So basically, the entanglement cooling can be modeled by a Markov chain, and this Markov chain, we computed the gap, and the gap of this Markov chain is exponentially small in the number of qubits. So this means that the time, the number of gates that you need to apply, is exponential, which is the same thing than exhaustive search. Okay? Okay, so my claim is that the impossibility of cooling, or the possibility of it, is a feature of solely the entanglement. So if this were the case, then I should be able to look at something that is what enters in the entanglement and be able to say whether I will be able to cool it or not without trying, right? I should be able to make a prevision. And as we saw in the previous plots, just how much entanglement you have doesn't tell you much. They all have maximum entanglement. So we need to look at something more refined than just how much entanglement you have. You may look at the statistics of the gaps in the entanglement spectrum. So you take your reduced density matrix, you diagonalize it, you have a spectrum, and you take the gaps in the spectrum and you make a statistics of it. And what we find is that for the Clifford group, the statistics is Poisson. Yeah.
Please, could you also look at, so I would expect that if you do the average entropy over the Clifford group, the fluctuations are going to be very large.
They're larger, yes.
So can you, is this also like a figure of merit?
How much the fluctuations are is something that we're working on now. So actually it seems that, preliminary results say that in both cases, fluctuations are exponentially small in the number of qubits, but with a different exponent. So the entanglement spectrum statistics of Clifford is Poisson, and the entanglement spectrum statistics of the universal set of gates is Wigner-Dyson. And this is very telling, because Wigner-Dyson is the expected distribution for the statistics of a gap of a random matrix. So, you see, this is like saying if the system is ergodic, in fact, the entanglement is the entanglement of a random matrix. Not only in how much entanglement you have, but in the statistics of the gaps. This is what is, it is the diagnostics that people have used to understand whether a Hamiltonian was chaotic or not in quantum theory. They would say, hey, if the gaps in the energies of the Hamiltonian are like that of a random matrix, okay, then it's like chaos. And if it is an integrable system, then it should not be like that, and people find it indeed Poisson. But you see, this is a completely different setting because there we are talking about the energies. These are not energies, these are the entanglement eigenvalues. So there is something very universal at play here. And this is also tells you whether it can be disentangled or not. Okay, so this is the first result. And how much you adhere or not to the statistics can be measured by the Kullback-Leiber divergence, and this is the result, the summary of the results. Yeah?
Does locality enter anywhere?
So, okay, so here the random quantum circuit is local in the sense that the gates are 1 qubit or 2 qubit gates. But here, in this setup, they are on a complete graph, so this means that we can address, for the qubit gates, we can address any pair of qubits.
Also, when you use the statistics of the entanglement spectrum to characterize the entanglement pattern, it seems to me locality doesn't enter. Am I right?
Well, okay, so of course, what entanglement, right? The entanglement of what? It's a bipartition. And so what bipartition? So here, this is the bipartition of half of the qubits. And the reason why we use half of the qubits and not one of the other bipartition is because we need many eigenvalues, right? So if we don't have many eigenvalues, it's very hard to make a statistics. But this is very robust. So for instance, if I go to a different bipartition, a different choice, or even a bipartition with less qubits, it becomes dirtier because I have less statistics, but it's still, or I have the same results. And of course, I can improve the statistics by doing more realizations because this is a random quantum circuit. So I can throw in, I can make up for the lack of eigenvalues by doing more realizations. So there is a trade-off to get as much statistics as you can, you need to do many realizations and have a very large system, which means half of the system, right?
Well, my question is, suppose you have a very large system and you have very well-defined statistics. This statistics is just the distribution of the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. It doesn't seem locality has entered.
So first of all, this is a distribution of the gaps. It's not a distribution of the eigenvalues. They're different things.
Oh, okay, but still the locality doesn't seem
to. We need to talk more about this, but there is something local because I've fixed the tensor product structure. I've told you what are the local degrees of freedom that tell you what is the TPS. You know, because entanglement is not something absolute, it does depend on the tensor product structure. The same state in another tensor product structure could be a product state. So a tensor product structure is, in my view, what you mean by what is local. Okay. Okay. Okay, so yeah, these are just a comment. This is a summary of what I said so far. Okay, so this is in a random quantum circuit. And then one, you know, since we drew all these metaphors here, oh, these are like the energies gaps, or we are talking about ergodicity, which is a notion that, you know, happens in quantum dynamics. What happens if instead of having a random quantum circuit, we have a Hamiltonian? So we take an initial state, which is not an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, we let it evolve with the Hamiltonian, and we see what happens. What lessons can we learn? So we use this model, which is an Heisenberg chain, and there is disorder, you see? So there is disorder in these coefficients, in these couplings. And this is a very interesting model because it has three regimes. For delta equals zero, this is the XX model, which is integrable, okay? So it is, in our metaphor, the same thing as the Clifford circuit. It should not be ergodic. For delta different from zero and low disorder, this Hamiltonian is chaotic and it obeys ETH, which is the eigenstate thermalization hypothesis. It means that every eigenstate of this Hamiltonian locally looks like a thermal state. And for an interacting system, a large disorder, this is the celebrated many-body localization, which is something that is localized but is many-body. So it has some features of an integrable system because you have, being localized, you have local integrals of the motion, but it is not exactly solvable. So it's like a non-integrable model. It's something in between. Okay. So let me skip this. So what we plot here are the statistics of the gaps in both the energy and the entanglement spectrum for the three regimes. So this is the entanglement spectrum, this row, this is the energy spectrum. So first of all, let's look at the statistics of the gaps in energy for the three systems, and we find always Poisson. Okay? So there is no way we can distinguish these three systems, in spite of the fact that I claim that people in the past said, hey, if you look at the statistics of the energy gaps, you can tell if the system is chaotic because a chaotic system should have a Wigner Dyson. So this is the one that should have a chaotic, should have Wigner Dyson, but we get Poisson. Wait a minute, so were people wrong before? Well, no, they were not wrong. What they did was to diagonalize the Hamiltonian in the subspace of a conserved quantity. So this Hamiltonian has a conserved quantity, which is the total spin in the z direction. And if you diagonalize the Hamiltonian in that subspace, well, in that subspace it is ergodic, and therefore you find, this is in the inset, we see that it adheres to Wigner-Dyson distribution. So it is chaotic. But because it has only one conserved quantity, so the phase space breaks in sectors that cannot be crossed, just one conserved quantity makes, if you don't know which one is the conserved quantity, and you put all the, you diagonalize the Hamiltonian in the full Hilbert space, then you don't realize that it's a chaotic Hamiltonian. Now, if the system is not integrable, you have no guarantee that you know what are the conserved quantities. There could be a few.
So this is to say, suppose I have a translational invariant system, and I just look at a fixed momentum, I also see...
Yeah, so if you have... So this system does not have translational invariants, but if you did have, then you should diagonalize your system in a subspace of a fixed momentum in order to see this effect. My point is that in general, if you, I give you a Hamiltonian that is not integrable, you don't know what are the conserved quantities, right? So how do you use it in practice? If we look at the entanglement spectrum, we find that the statistics of the gaps in the entanglement for the integrable system follows Poisson. For the non-integrable system, for ETH, the chaotic one, follows Wigner-Dyson. And for MBL, it's neither. It is in between.
So you take one state and do that statistics, or you take several states, you do the statistic, and then you average?
Okay, yeah, very good. Very, very good question. Okay, so this is obtained. So first of all, there is no real difference whether you take an eigenstate in the middle of the spectrum or if you do the quantum quench and the ball when you look at that state. So we do many realizations. And for each state, we take the reduced density matrix. We look at the eigenvalues. And we compute all the gaps. And then we do another realization, compute all the gaps, and then we throw, and so on and so forth, and then we throw all the gaps in the same bin. This is a way to improve the statistics.
Okay. But the state in the ETH, do you all take from the same symmetry sector, or you also take from different symmetry sectors?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so here we are breaking the, so the this breaks the symmetry.
But there's a conserved quantity, as you said.
Okay, yeah, I understand. Yeah, so this is a very excellent question. So you're asking whether this feature of the symmetry does not screw my statistics. It doesn't. So whether I break it or not, I always get Wigner-Dyson. Okay, so thank you for this question. It's an excellent point. Yeah, so this is one of the merits of this method. This is robust. This doesn't care about symmetry.
Just something minor. Did you try anything like besides Anderson
localization,
variable localization, did you try something like a
quasi-crystal? No, I didn't try
all the
other things. Yeah.
I mean, quasi-crystal.
What?
A quasi-crystal.
No, I didn't try that. No.
Do you expect?
For a quasi-crystal? So I'm not very familiar with quasi-crystals, so I don't know if they're expected to obey ETH or not. Are they expected to obey ETH? Yeah, I don't know. So, well, I need to see in the literature what they say. Okay. Okay, so you see these features. Oh, another thing. As I said, MBL shoots in between Wigner-Dyson and Poisson. What happens if we let MBL evolve for extremely long times, for exponential times? Then we can show that actually this converges to ETH. And the reason is, for those who know a bit about MBL, is that the conserved quantities of the motion are quasi-local, and their support increases in time, but logarithmically in time. So in order to, you know, screw up all the entanglement pattern, you need an exponential time. But if you wait that exponential time, then MBL does behave in the entanglement spectrum like ETH.
Exponential in system size?
Yes. Exponential system size.
But if you take a single eigenstate in MBL, we know its area law, then is that consistent with Wigner-Dyson distribution of the entanglement spectrum?
No.
So...
this is, again, a great question. The thing is that for MBL, the equivalence between what happens in an eigenstate and what happens in a quench is not there, exactly because it's not ETH. So the coherent evolution is different from what happens in a single eigenstate, exactly because it's not ETH.
Okay, so the plot that you're plotting is actually not taking several eigenstates to the average, you're actually doing quench and then...
Yeah, so for MBL there is a difference, but for this there is no difference between eigenstate and quench. Okay. Okay, so these plots, I need to go a bit faster. They show that if you observe MBL for a long time, it does converge to ETH. Okay. Now, can we disentangle them? Right? Because my claim was that this property of the entangled spectrum is telling you how complex is the landscape of entanglement, how difficult are these nearby states to be told apart, and this in turn means, okay, I can disentangle it or not. So now, of course, now we don't have a quantum random circuit. So how do we try our Metropolis algorithm? Well, what we can do is that we randomly pick terms in the Hamiltonian, and we exponentiate them and act with them for a very small time, epsilon. Okay, so this is our gate. So our gate is not a random gate from Clifford or from Universal, but it's a random gate that simulates a part of the time evolution that was induced by the Hamiltonian. Okay, so the red one is ETH, and it does not disentangle. And you see these very tiny little fluctuations here, just like when we had the universal quantum circuit. The blue one is the integrable one. And look, it does cool. It's lower to cool because here there is another effect of locality, because the couplings are, this is a spin chain, so the couplings are only local, so we're a bit less efficient. We're not on a complete graph, but it goes down. As you can see, the fluctuations are much larger. And MBL is in between. It has a very small slope, but it has a slope. So it is complex, so it's not like an integrable system, but it's not like the chaotic system. Oh, in the sense that, so yeah, let me say it again, that I pick a random term in the Hamiltonian, okay? So for instance, basically what I pick is I, okay? So I pick this term. So it's taken from the Hamiltonian and they exponentiate it.
For a small amount of time?
For epsilon time, yes. So if I pick from XX, I'm not picking this term, right? Because that would be zero. If I'm picking from MBL, I will have everything, but with a lot of noise here. Okay, so this complexity, this quantum complexity is revealed by the entanglement statistics, also tells us about the coolability and the learnability of these Hamiltonian evolutions. Okay, so now let me fast forward, and let me go back to the setting of quantum circuit. Okay, so these are more recent results. So we know that Clifford is not complex. Okay, you do not get Wigner-Dyson statistics, you get Poisson statistics. And now I ask, imagine I start with a random product state. I act with Clifford, and I sprinkle in between some T gates. T gates are those that are missing in order to have a universal set of gates. And then I keep evolving with another quantum random circuit. What happens? Can I drive a transition from Poisson to universal? Okay, so first notice that if I stop here, if I look at the statistics just after T, it's the same as before. T are 1-qubit gates, so they cannot change anything. They do not change the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix, right? So it's not the T gate per se that is changing this eigenvalues. However, what I'm doing here is that after this, I'm evolving them. If I evolve them, they spread. Right? There is a notion of operator spreading. They basically get addressed by these two unitaries, and they have a large support. They spread ballistically. So this is, by the way, something that people are looking a lot, in these days. Operator spreading as a diagnostic for quantum chaos. And we ask, can we drive this transition? And if yes, how many T gates do I need? And I say, very surprisingly, one T gate. So one seed of universality is enough to drive this transition from the Poisson distribution to the universal distribution of the entanglement spectrum statistics. Just one. And this is the plots that show that. Yeah?
Sorry, and you say driving to the transition, but do we know what's the quote unquote time scale or time steps to see this statistic from?
Yeah, okay, so if I have n qubits, each of these blocks contains n square gates. And n square is enough for having Clifford do all that Clifford can do, because after a while you keep repeating yourself. Yeah. But so one T gate is enough to drive this transition. We can also try a different setting that is like an out of time order correlation function. So what we can do is that we apply T dagger, a set of T gates, then we evolve with U. When we do T, which is the inverse of T dagger, and when we do U dagger now. So it is like evolving forward in time with the U and T dagger, and then evolving in back, but you do it out of time order. You swap T and U. Okay? Now this is a bit different from what we did before, because here, U and U prime are completely uncorrelated. They are two random things. Now U and U dagger, they are correlated. Okay, so one is the inverse of the other. And you ask, how many T's do I need to, when I get back, to get to the universal statistics? And now one is not enough, and you need the square root of n. So you need more because of this correlation. Okay, so we have a lot of open problems here. So first of all, so this is all numerical, and we would like to have some analytical results. I said we have one result. We can compute the gap of the Markov chain for the universal set of gates. We are in the process of computing the gap for the cooling algorithm for Poisson. We're not done yet. We have some problem in the proof. But for instance, we would like to prove that you have to get Poisson statistics. But there are other problems, like, computing this entanglement spectrum statistics is very costly. And that definitely has nothing to do with experiments, right? Because you cannot do quantum state tomography for a large system. So is there something else that tells us about this pattern of entanglement? I've said many times, look, the fluctuations are different. Maybe the fluctuations tell the whole story. So I don't know if they tell the whole story. But maybe it's only because of the different sides of the fluctuations that I cannot disentangle. And the fluctuations correspond to something. This is the fluctuations of the two Rényi entropy correspond to something that is very important in quantum information community, which is whether these circuits are able to make a four design. Okay, so if they're able to replicate not every moment of the R measure, that is the universal measure, but up to the four moment. And we know that the Clifford group is not a 4D sign. In fact, its fluctuations are not like this. But we also know that according to many tests, it can reproduce things that you would like from a 4D sign pretty well. So this means maybe it's not very very far from being a 4D sign. So the question is, I know that one T gate drives the transition from Poisson to GUE, which is the Wigner-Dyson distribution. Is it possible that one T gate drives the transition between 3D sign and 4D sign? So this, you see, this is a new way, a novel way of looking at these things. Like, so you are doping quantum circuits and trying to understand whether this doping drives you through transitions. Let's say that we discover, right now there is a student of mine that is trying to compute that. Let's say that we drive the transition to 4D signs with one T gate. Does it mean that they are these two transitions are one and the same? Or there are other classes in between? Or there are two different classes? So these are all open problems that I listed some of them here. And we're working on that, and I would be very happy, you know, to work with other people on that if that interests you. Okay, so because Leonard Susskind likes to put the laws of quantum complexity in his papers, I want to try the same. So I just state them without having to prove them, because. As I said, all these statistics, all this entanglement does depend on the tensor product structure. So if I want to make some statements, I have to put the tensor product structure in there. So the first law of quantum complexity should be something about quantum complexity, like energy, is something that should not increase. And maybe we can state in this way. If I compute the entanglement complexity across all the possible tensor product structures, no matter what is your state, you get always the same. It's the tensor product structure that tells you whether that state is complex or not from the entanglement point of view. The second law of quantum complexity should be, in every TPS, if you have a universal quantum evolution, then the complexity always increases. And with small fluctuations. When I say always increases, means, you know, locally you can have the complexity can go down, but fluctuations are very, very small.
Sorry, so how do you quantify the entanglement complexity?
So I don't have a number. So, you know, right now I'm just playing. Right, I'm saying it's so cool to, you know, state this law of quantum complexity. Maybe there is a way of putting a number on it.
Maybe it's a time scale that you use to put down the system.
Could be. Yes. So I'm open to suggestions. It's so much more fun that you announce the universal laws and then other people figure out. Yeah, so of course I'm playing right now. So this is not to be taken seriously, but as some kind of intuition that maybe can actually be made rigorous at some point. Okay, so I think I'm done. Thank you.
Can you repeat this T with other choices?
With other angles?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is another thing on our to-do list. Maybe you need to drive the transition from Clifford to universal. Anything that is not pi over 2 is okay.
Right, but for this purpose, is it enough? Okay, arbitrary, random angle.
Yeah, maybe it's enough.
Just for one insertion in the middle? like your
results? It's a great question. So this is on our to-do list. Yeah. Okay. Because we don't know how many complexity classes in this sense there are. Is this, maybe you have the transition to being a four design. Then you have the transition of becoming Wigner Dyson. Then you have the transition to being a universal quantum circuit. So we don't know if all these transitions, you know, are just one transition or not. Yeah?
In the figure with the T-gate in between, the blue and green Clifford's?
Yeah.
How deep does the second Clifford circuit need to be? To...
So N square and N square. N square gates and N square gates.
The green one also needs to be that deep.
Yeah, yeah. You need to be able to spread. Yeah?
Can you give an example of a state maybe that is complex in your sense but not complex in Susskind's sense?
Oh, yeah. So like all these states that I showed you, these are evolved with just N gates. So they have very little complexity for Susskind, because you only need the N gates to make them. But they belong to the same equivalence class of states that require an exponential number of gates. So the difference is, if you know what to do, you only need N. But if you need to look for them, you actually need the Xpen. And this is somehow the difference between Gibbs and Boltzmann point of view. So Boltzmann is not concerned with the ergodicity, with whether I reach that state or not. He's only concerned whether from some diagnosis, you know, from macroscopically, two states are distinguishable or not. If they're not, they belong to the same class. And the cardinality of that class tells you the entropy.
This is an open question, but you know, this relation of distance statistics and the thermodynamics can be simulated classically?
Yeah, so yeah, perfect. So Clifford group can be simulated classically, by the way. And of course, the universal one not.
Yeah, so do you think this could be like related to this difference that you see in this graph, for instance? Because I could imagine if your dynamics can be simulated.
Yes, it is related to that, because the fact that you cannot disentangle means that you have to look in an exponential number of things, which is, oh, it's not classic.
Because I guess what happens in the left-hand side is that the Markov chain is only within a finite group.
Yeah.
So it converges faster.
Yeah. From the application point of view, we know that one of the problems of quantum computing is, in fact, to make the T-gate. The Clifford group is easy to make in the lab. And the T-gate is hard. So if I only need square root n of T-gates to do all I need, well, that's quite interesting, right? Because the Clifford gates are cheap. So this also opens the possibility that you actually don't need many T-gates. It is possible because we do need a universal set of quantum gates, but we do not need to be able to make every possible gate, really, because a random state in Hilbert space is not very useful for quantum computation. Now I'm talking things that I don't know very well, so there are... I think Debbie should say something about this. Yeah.
Can I say that the sense of complexity is not stable by this definition, because you can insert a single stuff and make it from non-complex to complex.
Yeah, yeah,
so
and
it's not a stable quantity to your state.
Yes. So basically, I like that. So. You see here in the title I wrote this thing, a quantum KAM. So KAM theorem, Kolmogorov-Arnold-Morse, is something for classical dynamics. It's saying when you have an integrable system and you perturb it a little bit, do you destroy completely all the features of integrability? Is it stable or not? And classically, there is a notion of stability. That's why, you know, the orbits of the solar system are kind of like there, you know, they stay put for a while. And so do we have a quantum version of that? People have struggled forever trying to prove it in a very sophisticated way. But maybe this is another way to attack it. So now it depends on what setting you consider the onset of quantum chaos. If you say, oh, quantum chaos means to transition to RGUE, then it's not stable. But maybe another a better definition is whether the out-of-time order correlation functions are universal or not. For this setting where there is this correlation, you need the square root of n. So in this sense, there is a little bit of stability. But in any case, this is exactly what you're saying, is saying in what sense an integrable model is stable. And it's something rather fragile, but it's completely fragile or not. So these two settings, you have a different scaling. In one case is order one, the other case is square root of n. So right now it seems like you can say that it's stable or not stable depending on which of the two protocols you follow. Nowadays, people are inclined to take out-of-time order correlators as a measure of quantum chaos. So if we want to follow that wave, then okay, this is stable in some sense, because it requires square root of n.
Do we know how is the cooling time in the Kuiper circle scale with the system size?
Say again?
How is the cooling time in
n square.
N square?
N square, yeah. Well, n square is the experimental, I'm trying to prove that the gap is 1 over n squared, but I...
You mean the gap of that?
Of the Markov chain.
I see.
The gap of the Markov chain tells you how fast it converges to the stable distribution. Yeah.
Okay, maybe let's thank Alyosha again.